That was the year.
Recreating notable events of passing time. Reviving memories of men and women who have contributed to the history of a modern world.
That was the year.
Nanking, China, January 2.
Dr. Sun Yat-sen has declared himself provisional president of the Republic of China.
Peking, February 12.
It is hereby proclaimed that His Majesty, the Emperor of China, has abdicated the throne of his ancestors. The government of China has been transferred to the representatives of the people. It is further declared that the Constitution shall be republican in form. It is further declared that the Honorable Wan Shikai is granted full powers to organize a provisional government.
Nankin, February 15.
Dr. Sun Yat-sen has resigned the presidency of the Republic of China. The Honorable Wan Shikai has been elected.
Thus, with comparative ease and little bloodshed, was the infant emperor of the 3-century-old Manchu dynasty dethroned, and an infant republic born.
1912, that was the year.
Los Angeles, California, January 29.
I have repeatedly asserted that I knew nothing of the alleged bribery of the prospective jurors in the McNamara case. That assertion still stands. It is the truth. I have confidence that when the evidence is placed before the court in open trial, that fact will be established.
With this reiteration of his innocence, Clarence Darrow, attorney for the defense in the trial of the McNamara brothers for the bombing of the Los Angeles Times building the year before, prepared to go on trial himself on a charge of offering a $4,000 bribe to talisman George N. Lockwood.
August 17.
After a deliberation of only 21 minutes, the jury in the Darrow trial returned a verdict for the acquittal. Said attorney Darrow to newsmen,
"Well, it's been a long, hard ordeal. Of course, I had a great sense of relief at its close. None of those who knew me ever believed that I was corrupt, and their encouragement and faith has been my greatest help throughout this trial. I shall spend the rest of my life as I have in the past, doing the best I can to serve the cause of the poor."
Mr. Darrow.
Oh, hello, Judge Hutton.
Mr. Darrow, from a million throats all over the land, will go up hallelujahs as a result of that verdict.
Well, thanks, Your Honor. Thanks. I intend calling on you soon.
I shall be most honored to have you as my guest, Mr. Darrow. Goodbye, and God bless you.
1912. That was the year.
Southampton, England, Wednesday, April 10. The new 46,000-ton pride of the White Star Line, the Titanic, leaves her berth and carrying 1,316 passengers, 892 officers and crew on her maiden voyage, points her high bow westward toward a gaily decorated pier awaiting her arrival in New York Harbor. Many Britons and Americans had delayed their passage to the U.S. in order to travel on the unsinkable ship, but none of the passengers considered it necessary to inquire as to lifeboat equipment. Had they done so, they would have discovered that the Titanic was certified to carry 3,547 persons, but carried boats for only 1,178, less than half the ship's capacity, but more than double the antiquated requirements of the British Board of Trade Law of 1894, which had not been revised for 18 years. Sunday, April 14, at about 9 p.m., Captain E.J. Smith, 30 years on the sea without an accident, Commodore of the White Star Line and Master of the Titanic, comes out of the bridge where Chief Officer Murdoch is in command.
Getting quite chilly, Mr. Murdoch.
Yes, sir. Dropped from 43 to 30 degrees since 6:30.
Any more iceberg warnings?
Not for some time, sir. The navigators reckon we should be in their field about 11 p.m.
I see. Well, I'm going to my cabin. Be sure to call if there's any doubt about the visibility.
Very good, sir.
Anything new, Phillips?
No, sir. Just routine.
Very well. Good night.
Good night, sir.
And while the 882-foot liner, ablaze with light, cuts the icy Atlantic at a speed of 24.5 knots, Cyril Evans, 20-year-old radio operator of the steamship Californian, prepares to close down his equipment at about 11:30 p.m.
Oh, hello, Mr. Groves. You off watch?
Yep, Mr. Stone's just come on. You going off?
Oh, yes, sir. I've been on for 16 hours.
You'll get used to that. The La Follette 8-hour-day law didn't help you radio boys any. What ships did you get?
Oh, only the Titanic.
Did you tell him we were stalled here with ice?
I tried to, but their Sparks told me to shut up, that he was busy with Cape Race.
How far away was she?
Oh, about 40 miles then. Ought to be about 20 miles from us about now.
Yeah. Well, good night, kid.
Good night, sir.
At 11:40 p.m., Chief Officer Murdoch on the bridge of the Titanic. Here's an ominous signal from the lookout. A three-bell warning that something is ahead.
What is it, fleet?
Iceberg dead ahead.
Hard to starboard. Reverse engines. Close the watertight doors.
Murdoch, what was that?
Iceberg, sir.
My God. Phillips.
Yes, sir?
We've struck an iceberg. Stand by to send out a call for help. I'm having an inspection made right now to see what the damage is.
Yes, sir. Well, what do you make of that?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know what help we could need. The ship can't sink.
I should say not.
Phillips, send out the call.
Which call, sir?
The regular call for help.
Yes, sir.
The nearest ship to the ill-fated Titanic was the Californian, only about 12 miles away. But her radio equipment had been shut down and her operator gone to bed. Other ships did receive the frantic CQD messages, however, among them the Carpathia, 58 miles away. Hardly believing his ears when told of the frantic calls for help, Captain Arthur Rostron barked out his famous command.
North, 52, west.
And the Carpathia began her history-making race with death, raising her usual speed from 14 to more than 17 knots. Joining in the dash were the German steamship Frankfurt, 153 miles away, the Baltic, and the Russian steamer Burma, 70 miles away. When the Carpathia reached the vicinity of latitude 41 minutes, 46 seconds north, longitude 50 minutes, 14 seconds west, in the dead calm before dawn, all that was seen was a few pitiable lifeboats, some carrying only half capacity. In all, there were but 712 survivors. An hour and a half before the Carpathia's arrival, the Titanic had pointed her bow downward and slipped quietly into the glassy sea, taking with her 1,517 men, women, and children.
1912, that was the year.
Milwaukee, Wisconsin, October 14. Following a split in the Republican National Convention, in which boosters for Theodore Roosevelt bolted, the nation's voters found themselves confronted with three major candidates: Republican incumbent William Howard Taft, progressive Roosevelt, and Democrat Woodrow Wilson. With old-time characteristic Rooseveltian vigor and tenacity, T.R. began his speech-making tour of the country. On this evening, October 14, as he leaves the Hotel Gilpatrick to speak at the auditorium, he hears a shot, feels a burning sensation in his chest. Three men in the Roosevelt party leap upon the would-be assassin, but Roosevelt cries out from his automobile,
"Don't hurt him! I'm all right.
Are you okay, Teddy?
My good friends, I'm not hurt. I'm going on to the hall to speak. Good luck.
Attaboy,
I'll just run the car up to the auditorium. I'm not hurt, and everything is all right."
Arriving at the auditorium, Roosevelt begins his speech, at the same time removing his folded manuscript from his inside coat pocket.
Fellow citizens of Wisconsin.
Colonel, there's blood on that paper and on your shirt front.
Now, Dr. Terrell, you just stay where you are. I'm going to make this speech and you might as well compose yourself. Friends, I shall have to ask you to be as quiet as possible. I do not know whether you fully understand that I have just been shot, but it takes more than that to kill a bull moose. It is a very natural thing that weak and vicious minds should be inflamed to acts of violence by the kind of mendacity and abuse that have been heaped upon me for the last 3 months by the papers in the interests not only of Mr. Debs, but of Mr. Wilson and Mr. Taft. Friends, I will disown and repudiate any man of my party who attacks with such vile, foul slander and abuse any opponents of any other party.
Perhaps part of the abuse to which T.R. referred was the casting abroad upon the streets of Chicago of thousands of handbills reading,
"At 3 o'clock Thursday afternoon, Theodore Roosevelt will walk on the waters of Lake Michigan."
At any rate, in the subsequent election, he carried 6 states to Taft's 4, while Woodrow Wilson carried 40 states to become the 28th president of the U.S.
1912, that was the year
that Terpsichorean addicts shuffled along to this toe-tickling ditty.
Way down on the levee, in old Alabama, there's Daddy and Mammy, there's Ephraim and Sammy, on a moonlight night you can find them all, while they are waiting, the banjos are syncopating, what that they're saying, oh what that they're saying, oh while they keep playing, and humming and swaying, it's the good ship, Robert E. Lee, that comes to carry the cotton away. Oh, come and watch them shuffling along. See them shuffling along. So take your best gal, real pal. Go down to the levee.
I said to the levee, you can
join that shuffling throng. Hear that music and song. It's simply cray-cray. Waiting on the levee. Waiting for the Robert E. Lee. On the levee, waiting for the Robert E. Lee.